Hello, this is Justice Radio, a weekly show on WMPG with your host, Linda Small. I'm Executive Director of Reentry Sisters, an organization that specializes in helping women and girls return home from prison. And you can learn more about our work on our website at reentrysisters.org. Today, we are speaking with Foster Graves, the president of the NAACP branch at the Maine State Prison, about his leadership and the goals and challenges and aspirations of the NAACP. Welcome, Foster. Thanks so much for coming on our show.
Anytime. How are you doing today?
We're doing great. So for our listeners who are meeting you for the first time, Foster, how would you introduce yourself beyond your title as president of the NAACP?
I introduce myself as Foster Bates, understanding, considerate, mindful of people who I'm around, and make sure that I put others before myself. I try to assist as many people I can, regardless of my circumstances.
That's beautiful, Foster. That sounds like it aligns with the values of the NAACP itself, right? So
yes.
What first drew you to leadership and advocacy work?
Actually, I wasn't drawn here. I actually did not want to be a part of the Maine State Prison NAACP branch when I first got here, because I was just incarcerated and I had some falling outs with the Portland branch when I first got incarcerated. But then when I started looking at and reading the policies at Maine State Prison, I realized that there was a problem with a lot of the policies. And one of the policies I had started reading first was the publications, mail, books, that it was denying people an opportunity to receive their material, magazines and books in the mail without being destroyed or being flat out denied without being notified that their magazines and books was being destroyed or returned to the sender.
Wow. So you were really interested, I guess, in righting wrongs that you were seeing going on around you. And I imagine in your current situation, you see a whole lot of that on a daily basis, right?
That is correct.
So what does leadership mean to you when you're organizing inside the carceral environment? That you've got to have some huge challenges and barriers.
Well, leadership for me means having people understand that just because you're a leader doesn't mean that you're authoritarian. That means everything runs into democracy. You take people's beliefs and consideration, their values into consideration. You open up, you dialogue, you talk with them before you make a decision. I'm at Maine State Prison. Under my presidency, one of the things that I do is I make sure that everyone's involved, everyone's engaged. It's just not one person making a decision. So within the community, when we make decisions, we try to make sure that everybody who wants to be involved has a say into what we're doing and how we're going about doing it. That's how we structure our general meetings, and that's how we structure our executive board meetings.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that structure? How does that actually work, and how do people raise their voices? Is that through a meeting, or do they write in? How does that process actually work?
Actually, we have a two-step process. You can reach out to any one of our executive board members. We have five executive board members: president, the vice president, second vice president, a secretary, and a treasurer. We also have an opportunity where we can put together subcommittees to address particular issues. For example, if we want to work on a disciplinary policy, we can put together subcommittees just to handle disciplinary procedures, as well as grievance procedures and medical grievances of those particular things there. And also, we have a meeting once a month, the last Friday of each month. Any resident, you don't have to be a member, any resident can come to the meeting and express any concerns that they have. Sometimes we take a vote on the floor. If it's a real serious issue that needs to be addressed right away, we have a vote on the floor. If it's just an issue that is kind of like minor, doesn't need to be addressed right away, then we just take it under advisement, then we proceed. We try to make sure that issues that we deal with affects the entire Department of Corrections, not just one particular individual, because we're not attorneys and we don't handle anything for someone on an individual basis. We try to make sure that the totality of the scream of things is what that person going through. Is it going to have a deterrent or detriment? Not a deterrent, but is it going to have a detriment to the policy procedures that we're all under?
Sounds like you built your own little democracy inside a very oppressive and authoritarian regime that you're in there under every single day, right? That's pretty ironic. So I know you mentioned a couple of things like grievance policy, maybe some health concerns or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about some of the issues your chapter is working on right now?
Well, right now we're back again working against the disciplinary policy. That's one of the things that we go through from time to time. They changed the policy that allows disciplinary sanctions on things that would be considered just minor violations. They increased the penalty without notifying residents that they're going to be increasing these penalties or giving us full notice or explanation or reason to ask what these penalties would entail. So we're going to get together and hopefully file a prison initiative and reach out to the Joint Standing Committee for legislative review of that particular policy. One of the things we've done the past few years was medical. We had a situation where people was not being seen or treated medically wise. So we had to take that to the media. We took it to the media. Then we was able to get a meeting with the commissioner. At that time, it was Deputy Commissioner Ryan Thornell, who's no longer with the Department of Corrections. And we had WellPath come in. And we did meetings with the Department of Corrections for almost 3 years, where we would meet quarterly. We got a lot of things done. A lot of people who had medical issues that were chronic were able to get treated and seen, sent out to hospital. So the department has since revised some of their policies and triaged the residents who need to go out to for medical treatment.
Wow, congratulations. That's really a significant win. Yeah. It sounds like, right, you're sort of the internal watchdogs there. And so I imagine that must be one of the things that you're really proud of, is actually helping people live better lives on the inside. Is there anything else you want to share about any wins, big or small, that you all are proud of that you've accomplished?
Wow, let's see. I don't even really know where to begin. We have some extraordinary wins. I'll take you all the way back. Let's go back and see if I can recall 20 years.
Wow.
In a short period of time. One of the first wins we had, I would have to say, was the phone prices. We were dealing with phone prices that was $36 a minute plus a $5, I think, connection fee. We was able to convince the Department of Corrections to go from 36 minutes down to 32 minutes and then down to 24 before the FCC stepped in and finally dropped it down. That was probably our first biggest accomplishment.
Nice.
Then the next accomplishment was the monetary sanction policy. Residents were paying $100 for a Class A write-up, $75 for a Class B write-up, and $50 for a Class C write-up. So you can see every write-up you get, they can charge you $100. So if you receive the write-up that was a Class A and a Class B, that's $175. So in 2014, the warden, which was at the time, now the Commissioner Randall Liberty, saw exactly what he was talking about, and he basically did away with monetary sanction. He put together a policy in place that would only charge someone a monetary sanction on the most serious offenses. So you basically cannot receive a monetary sanction on any other Class A write-ups unless it violates those particular six or seven classes that they put into place. And the next victory we had was, this is kind of like minor, but we were able, I won't say minor, but we was able to get a canteen annex at the facility, which is like another store
than
what we have. So we was able to get that. When Commissioner Liberty became commissioner, was able to get that. And then the most recent victory we had was Good Time. We've been battling to have the Good Time policy at the facility change that would only withdraw Good Time for the most serious offenses. This is being passed and should be becoming active sometime this month or early March, which is that you can no longer lose Good Time for any minor offenses. Prior to, if you have a Class B or Class C write-up, you can lose anywhere between 5 to 15 days. If people was actually losing Good Time for just not making their beds or being out of place or being tagged in for 3 hours on basic minor violations. So that became a problem. So the commissioner ran the Liberty, adhered to that, and he did away with that. So we have a new policy coming out, and you can only receive loss of Good Time on any for Class A write-ups, Class A violations. And the one thing that I always like to tell people is that we have an education department, and our college program was essentially started at Maine State Prison because of Joseph Jackson at MPAC. He reached out to Doris Buffett and sent her a letter expressing that he would like to finish his college degree. And she responded to his letter, and she came in and she donated a whole bunch of money and started what was called the Doris Buffett Sunshine Lady Foundation. And since that time, the program has expanded to master's degrees and PhD. A lot of people don't know, it started with a letter from Joseph Jackson, and MSP College Education started with, at the time, President Michael Parker, who then reached out to, I guess, everybody under the sun, you can pretty much say, to get a college program at this facility. And I, myself, graduated from the Doris Buffett Sunshine Lady Foundation in 2011 with my bachelor's degree. Prior to, I was at Suffolk University pursuing pre-law, criminal justice and law there, and then, to go forward. And then here I am. So I was able to accomplish that because of one person or two people, Joseph Jackson and Michael Parker, their vision helped us get to where we are today.
Wow, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing it. So impressive. I mean, when you talk about, people don't realize, phone prices, that determines how much connection you have with your family and loved ones, right? And then people aren't really understanding the discipline policy, right? If you're going to get charged $175 and you make 25 cents an hour, that takes up either a lot of your own money earning capacity, or your families will suffer because they're the ones that have to foot that bill, right? And it's really astonishing listening to you talk about the good time policy, because for our listeners to understand that, losing good time actually means you're staying in prison longer.
Yes.
So technically, it's increasing the length of your sentence, especially when you look at things like you mentioned, things like not making your bed or some smaller violations that really shouldn't be carrying that type of sanction. And I just want to say, God bless Doris
Yes.
Buffett.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Wonderful, wonderful lady. And congratulations on your BA. And I hope you do continue on to law school.
Maine currently has the strictest sentencing guidelines in the country. When they abolished parole in 1976, they were supposed to do a downward departure on sentencing to make up for the loss of parole. They took away the good time and made good time more restrictive. Currently, prisoners, residents, inmates, however you want to classify it, are serving 85% to 90% of their sentences. When you then take someone's good time for a minor violation, now you're looking at a person serving upward near 100% of their time. However, there's a mechanism, avenue for the person to receive the good time back. You have to write a request to the warden, and the warden can decide whether he wants to reinstate the good time that was lost. Some people get it back, some people don't. So what the NAACP is doing, we've been working on for the past 15 years on revising the good time statutes. Maine has three different good time codes: a 1983, a 1995, and a 2004. And those good time laws are completely different. In some regards, they're discriminatory against one another, because I can be in the program with one person and receive 5 days a month, and that person can receive two. So there's a discriminatory factor there, and we're taking the same class. So we've been working on that particular aspect, and we've been running into roadblocks after roadblock after roadblock, because they're talking about it, any good time given to those who are currently incarcerated would affect the governor's separation of power clause. I've read Article 2 and 4, and I don't see where it runs into it, but this is what legislators keep saying. We've met in 2011. We met with, I always say Paul Pelletier, but I think his name is John Pelletier from CLAT. Real, real good meeting with him. And he kind of like helped us understand where the problems would be, because they're looking at commutation. So when you view commutation, you're giving someone time off the sentence and sending them home. That's the essence of basic commutation. Or you're going to reduce this resentence enough that they have a chance to go home in the near future. Earned good time is the opposite, because if you don't do programming, then you can't get the good time in which we're requesting. So we've been working on that, and intensively. It's still working on it to this day.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Anybody who's involved in this type of things knows how complicated that is. And if you have three different good time laws based on when you were sentenced, it gets very complicated very quickly. And the other thing I think our listeners should know is that clemency is just, to me, it's used as an excuse to not overhaul the good time system because we're not exercising it. Our governor doesn't exercise clemency and has not, despite the number of very qualified folks who've done the hard work of rehabilitation and who are ready to be released, and they're remaining in prison is serving no purpose whatsoever, and they're not no longer a risk. And so that's really a sad state of affairs, I think, and things that people don't normally think about.
That is
So,
true.
yeah. You are listening to Justice Radio with your host, Linda Small, and today we are speaking with Foster Bates, the president of the Maine State Prison Branch of the NAACP. So, Foster, I'm going to turn a little bit towards systemic harm, race, injustice. And you were talking earlier, calling back to the good time conversation we were having, where there's certain good time taking that you can write and ask for it back. And you said some people get it and some people don't. So on that note, I want to ask you, obviously the NAACP has always been rooted in racial justice. So how do you see race showing up inside the prison system? And are there disparities or patterns that you think the public should know and be paying closer attention to?
You might have to schedule another radio conversation for this one.
This would be part two.
Yeah, so So this is it. Wow. Let me begin. Okay, first and foremost, I've been here far too long. And when I first got here, I noticed it right away. Some people try to put it off as nepotism. I don't put it off as nepotism. I put it off as discriminatory action, discriminatory practice. When you can blatantly see the difference between how Black and brown people are being treated within this environment versus their counterpart, and it's so open and blatant. Give you an example. Minor things, right? I'll give you something minor. You might have an African-American person standing by somebody's door on a top tier. Staff member walk by, tell him to move along, and then walk by his counterpart three or four cells down and don't say nothing to that person. Let him stay right there. That's that particular thing. When it comes to just giving things out, like for example, I'll take a little bit bigger. When it comes to supervised community confinement program, the number speaks for itself. Limited African Americans in that program. That's not by accident. I don't know if it's by design, but I'm hard pressed to believe that we have a good number of African Americans that may stay prison, and none of them qualify for supervised community confinement. And I don't know what the women's numbers are, but that's a problem. When you have African Americans who go to minimum security facilities and being racially discriminated against and then sent back to Maine State Prison for a minor violation when you have their counterparts staying there. Those are things that jump out to me. I don't know if it's because they're not aware that they're being discriminatory, or is it just so accustomed to not understanding the people who are there around, the people in their custody. But it is a systemic problem. I says, in fact, I think it was Mountain View had issues up in their facility dealing with discriminatory practice in that facility. We tried to get a meeting with the administration about those particular issues, and we really couldn't get the meetings that we wanted to have surrounding those issues because it's so systemic throughout. We have people coming in from other facilities saying that, you know, the guy down there doing certain things and not being sent back to the prison, but mostly African Americans and brown people are. That's open. It's obvious. I think it's explicit bias. I don't think they really understand what discriminatory practice is. You do not have to be racist to discriminate, because discrimination is not about your color. We're not saying racial discrimination. We're saying you're discriminating against people who are in your custody because people are being treated differently. Give you another example. When you see certain organizations doing things and then you see the NAACP being denied the same things that those other organizations are doing, that is discrimination, right? It's discriminatory practice. So it's here. To me, I see it openly and plainly. Other people may not see it that I see it. But when you have people who are coming into the facility, young African-Americans coming into the facility, and they see the same thing I've been seeing for the past 20 years, then you know there's a problem. We have a couple of African-Americans who are over in, which is a different building than I'm in, been trying to get into the education department. They have a year left and they're being denied education, but then people who are coming in from Wyndham get right into education. You know, that's a problem. We have situations over here when a person gets in trouble in my building, and if he's African-American, he gets shipped to a different building that's more restrictive, and then the counterparts are not. And I'll give you a most recent example. There was a situation that occurred on the mile with two Caucasian residents, and I'm happy the result worked out for everybody. Something happened. Neither one of those individuals got lugged, which means, you know, they got in somewhat trouble, but I won't say a lot of trouble. They didn't get lugged. They got brought back to the same housing unit, and I'm assuming that they may have got written up. Don't know. However, another African-American was moved to the 500 building without a reason. Just said that, well, his previous write-ups doesn't dictate that he should be in a less secure building. But the two people who got into the fight are still in this building. So explain that.
Thank you for those examples. I really appreciate it. And one of the most disturbing facts, I think, for Maine is we have the sixth highest racial disparity in the country about the way we lock up Black and brown people, which really means Maine locks up more Black and brown people than 44 other states in this country. And that's an embarrassing fact to begin with, because Maine is a mostly white state, right?
Yes.
And so that type of systemic discrimination on the outside, pushing people into the system, I would imagine is just compounded, just like the examples that you were giving us about things happening.
I'm happy that the two gentlemen that had the situation, believe me, I was pleased to see the outcome, because that wouldn't have been the outcome years ago. So it says the Department of Corrections is trying to turn the corner and try a new different approach to these particular instances, because I'm assuming that the individual agreed that no further incident would occur. I was proud of that. I was happy about that. But on the downside of that, I didn't agree with how they handled the other situation with the other young man, because his write-ups were past write-ups, and they weren't violent. They weren't egregious. They were minor, right? And NAACP had fought with that, and we spoke about that a little bit. But when you look at the totality of the 2.6% of African Americans minorities in the state of Maine, you have 34% being incarcerated statewide, and at Maine State Prison you have 14% in this facility, right? So that's a large number, and a lot of the young African American men who are here now, some of them are Somalian, some of them are Sudanese, and they really don't understand or start to just understand what the system looks like in here. But when they can see the race, the discriminatory and racist tactics that's taking place within this facility, and they don't really understand the system, but they can see it with their own eyes based on their own experience. They can call it out and acknowledge it. And I think that's the problem that ministerially and Department of Corrections, I think we have to fix and try to get it fixed and have more education. The Maine Department of Correction hired a diversity, equity, inclusion manager. He's been doing the best that he can, but I think trying to get more classes and more understanding and more education to staff members and other residents based on, you know, the dynamics of this particular state in these facilities is always helpful. And I think education is always the key when it comes to any type of discrimination and racism, just within the state alone, just not even worrying about what it is nationwide.
Yeah, that's a good point, Foster. And, you know, it's really hard to change people's hearts and minds, but I think you're right. It starts with education and awareness to begin with. You can't pick something that you're not aware of or that you refuse to be aware of. And I find I struggle to think that people aren't aware. It's a question of whether you're willing to take action and change or not. So yeah, on that vein, I want to ask your opinion of when you hear the word abolition, what does that mean to you?
It means unity. People standing up together to come to resolve on issues that affect not just certain individuals, but affect everybody. Racism doesn't affect just one nationality. It affects everybody. Discrimination doesn't affect one person. It affects everybody. It's the thought process that goes into it. So one person action can lead to the action that can harm hundreds and thousands and millions of people. If you look at the streets today, when you look at, you go back to George Floyd, it wasn't just African Americans in those communities. It was a collection of people. When you look at what's going on today in our communities with ICE, you look at what's going on in Minnesota, it's a collection of people. It's the voice of the people who are trying to resolve issues that's affecting everybody, not just a certain class of people. The NAACP was founded in 1909, but it wasn't founded by one particular African-American. It was founded by a group of people. We're actually a multicultural organization. And my board at Maine State Prison is multicultural. I may be the president of African American descent, but my board members are diverse. And that's because people in the facility at the time, when they step up and want to be more involved, we get people from different races. And that's what makes, you know, this particular branch unique. That's what makes this facility unique. We have another organization here called the Longtimers. They do an excellent job when it comes to all the operations of the facility and daily life of the resident. You know, they try to bring a lot of things into the facility, and I commend them for doing a lot of great things they do. The difference between us and them is that we focus mostly on policies, and they focus mostly on the daily living of the facility. And I think when we have those two brands working hand in hand, we get a lot done. Sometimes it takes longer than we like, but things do get done. When those things come together, you look at the diversities in each group, and you look at the diversity of how the NAACP was founded in 1909, and I think that says a lot.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. I love that abolition equals unity. I think that's great. And talking about systems that affect everyone, because the carceral system affects everyone, whether you're incarcerated or not, right? What do you wish people on the outside understood about life on the inside?
I wish people on the outside would understand that don't judge a person by their worst mistake. I think redemption leads to forgiveness. I think if you have people working on themselves, trying to better their life for themselves and their families and their community, I think that takes a lot of courage. These environments breeds a lot of toxicity, a lot of negative. And when you have people trying to rise above the negative and do positive things, I think they should be incentivized. I think they should be commended for that. Not faced with the door slamming at every opportunity, every turn. We have people at Maine State Prison that get out tomorrow. What are they getting out to? Are they getting out to hope, or are they getting out to frustration and anger? And feeling, realizing that, you know, that they not want it back in society except by their families, if their families even want it back. So I think that's where our communities come in. I think our communities come in by uplifting those who are being incarcerated. Maine has a high recidivism rate, but the recidivism rate fluctuates. It's lower than the nation's average, right? They don't have parole. And what you look at is, has, since the parole has been abolished, has the crime rate and recidivism rate dropped, right? I said it fluctuates. So with that fluctuation, it says that Maine is still the safest state in the union. And if we're the safest state in the union, and you have people going out realizing that they made a mistake, but they can't get a job, they can't get housing, and they can't even get a license. So there's some legislation that my understanding, they want to attach incarceration to your license. So how do you expect a person to get back up on his feet and put together a productive life if you're trying to make it even more complicated by attaching a license to a criminal conviction? That's absurd. So it comes down to, are they really trying to help those who are incarcerated or trying to continue further hindering? And I heard this saying before that incarceration follows you outside. Reform never ends for those who are incarcerated. And I agree. You know, I agree. We have some wonderful people in the community like yourself, like Joseph Jackson, like Brandon Brown, like Antonio Jackson, doing wonderful things. Mikko Allison, they're doing wonderful things in the community. And they did it because they was able to get the support that they needed. Some people don't have that support. And that's where IMPAC and Reentry Sisters and NAACP and all these other organizations. Yeah. I like the idea of sisters and brothers. I like that idea.
Yeah. I do too. I do too. I have toyed with the idea of expanding it to Reentry Sisters and Brothers. So that's a story for another day. Yeah, I love the talk about redemption and welcoming people home, because quite frankly, every sentence, no matter how long it is a life sentence here in the state of Maine, just never goes away. And on that sort of very sad note, I want to ask you one last question, Foster. What gives you hope right now?
Wow. My hope comes from my family, my children, my friends, such as you. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. I'll give you how I feel. There's days where I just feel like just giving up, literally. But I realize that I can't give up. I have to keep fighting, if not for myself, for those who are around me. When I think about how long I've been incarcerated, things that I miss, and then I think about the people in the community who's still fighting. You know, they're still out there, just still fighting for everybody who's inside. So I told myself every day, not today, not tomorrow, not ever. You got to get up and keep grinding. I may get worried, but I don't get tired. I get frustrated. I get angry, but I control that in myself. Sometimes I find myself just taking naps because I'd be so frustrated. It's just let me take a nap. Hopefully when I wake up, the frustration's gone. But I get my strength and my hope from my peoples, you know, my constituents and my friends. That's where I get all my hope for. And I tell you, though, my biggest inspiration since I've been incarcerated, I have to give her much respect, is Senator Rachel Talbot Ross. Watching that woman work in the 20 years I've been here has been remarkable. Watching her come into this facility just as a community leader out of Portland and then sit in a meeting with us and say, hey, I can't do this way anymore. I need to go something different. I'm like, well, where are you thinking about going? He goes, I have to become a state representative. She became a state representative.
Yeah, she did.
Right here. She announced it right here at Maine State Prison.
That's awesome.
And she became, and we was like, yeah, okay, we're going to make sure you get some votes out of here. And she did that. And look where she is now. And every time I think about her, I think about her father, the work he's done. I think about Winston McGill and just the African-American community here in Maine. They never gave up. So I'm like, I got the audacity to think that I could just give up and walk away? You got to be crazy.
Yeah, no one's going to let you do that. That's for sure.
And then hearing Bob Green speak at the NAACP event this past Friday and just the knowledge he gave about the 1700s, how there was African-Americans in Maine before the Mayflower.
It's an amazing story. Yes. Amazing story. Well, thank you so much, Foster.
You're welcome. Anytime.
For joining us.
This is great.
We'll have to have part two sometime.
Okay, absolutely.
Yeah. So listeners, we have some exciting new shows coming to Justice Radio with our new host from Healing First, a transformative justice collective led by survivors of harm, advocating for restorative and transformative justice processes as widely accessible options for everyone. So please visit Justice Radio show page on WMPG.org for our archived episodes aired on WMPG, WERU, and WMHB. And a big thank you to our editor, Aaron Pyle, and to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode of our series.